My name is Greg Dorst. I'm an alcoholic. So nice to see. Have you guys seen the view from up here? You guys are pretty people. You clean up really, really well. The only problem is I don't have my glasses, so I kind of made that up. Hey, you guys, I got to tell you, are pretty amazing people. And I have enjoyed this immensely. This is my first ILAA. I have been involved with Lawyers in Recovery for an awfully long time, and I was a magnificent lawyer who was not in recovery for quite some time. But I am enamored with this group. I just love you guys. I think you have amazing spirits. I think that you... I think you're so good that I'm going to Nashville. Now, how about that? Huh? Yeah, Nashville. So I played in the Humility Cup. I'm not sure why it's called the Humility Cup, but there were, about seven of us, seven foursomes in the Humility Cup. But the neatest thing about the Humility Cup was I got to play with guys I hadn't known before. And so by the time you're through with 6 hours of golf, you know them really, really well. So we did not win, but that's okay. That goes with the theme of humility. But there was a very humble group that did win, and I'm very familiar with all those groups. Congratulations, you guys. Now, the interesting thing about humility is that once the ego recognizes that it's an advanced spiritual state, it starts to attach to it, you know, and it's kind of one of these things where you're looking at other people wondering whether or not you're more humble than they are, you know. I think I've got more humility than that guy does. I got more humility than that guy. So as an advanced spiritual state, you know, we start measuring and judging, and so it's really kind of a funny thing. You know, it happens in AA a lot. The guy who has the most humility, you know, is the one who gets up and talks about it. So it's kind of fun, Humility Cup. I just really get that. It reminds me of a really interesting joke, and I love this. I absolutely love this joke because it's kind of sophisticated. You really have to be one of us to understand it fully. So this could be a church, a synagogue. It could be an ashram or anything. But the head person one day is walking through the temple area and just is moved to get down on his knees and start wailing, "Lord, I'm not worthy. I'm not worthy. Lord, I'm not worthy." And the assistant sees this as he's walking through and says that to himself. He's very moved. So he says, "I'm going to do that too." So he gets down on his knees and begins to wail, "Lord, I'm not worthy." And the two of them are going, "Lord, I'm not worthy." Soon, a janitor comes walking through, and he is quite moved as well. So he sets himself down and starts to wail, "Lord, I'm not worthy. I'm not worthy." The assistant starts to nudge the head guy and says, "Look who thinks he's not worthy." Which falls right in line with that humility contest, you know? So I'm very glad to be here. This is... not the space you want to be in, you know, the spiritual speaker, because everybody expects something spiritual from me, particularly because I have changed careers several times, and one of the careers that I now have is as a minister, and so people are expecting me to not cuss, and how do you tell your story without a few of those choice words? You know, how do you do that? And so there may be a bit of a conundrum. I will tell you this right up front, that if I do cuss, that's my old me. See, that's the less enlightened me. So just so you know where we are with that. I am an alcoholic. I got my recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous. I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and it put me on a path that I never would have found. So I have this worldview. I have this world, and we're going to be talking a little bit about worldviews, because my worldview has changed over the years greatly. I have this worldview today as a result of having gone through a program of recovery. I needed it. I had a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. You know, I'm an alcoholic, need all the help I can get. And I realized that this program really is about changing worldviews. So I went from the victim to a place where I understood that everything that happens in my life and in life in general adds to my awareness. So I have this worldview that everything that happens, no matter if it seems bad or good, adds to my awareness. And I'm increasingly more aware with everything that happens in my life. And I like that worldview because it allows me to see the truth in my situation, which is that those bad things that happened were really a springboard for something much more magnificent. My sponsor used to say, you are a great example of the trampoline effect. The farther you can go down, the higher you can go up. So I love the trampoline effect, the idea that we can reach those low limits, but we have the sky as our limit. So my low bottom story is very interesting. It began in Fontana. I was born in Kaiser Hospital in Fontana. My father was a steel mill worker. And that was back in the days when you actually had to have a felony conviction in order to live in Fontana. Fontana, California is one of those places that's really rough. You know, really, really rough. Today, I believe they have relaxed the standards a little bit. If you're from that area, you may know that you only have to have a misdemeanor conviction today to live in that particular area. My wife and I actually had to move from the Inland Empire area. I don't know why they call it that. Not much of an empire, but, you know, for those of us that live in the Inland Empire, we are absolutely stunningly blessed. But I moved to with my wife to Covina. And we got sober in Covina. We got sober in Covina 16 years ago. Now, Covina, if you walk into the main AA, the Alano Club there, the AA Club, there's a big sign on the wall that says, Covina, the sobriety capital of the world. If you've ever been in that place, you'll see that. So Covina, the sobriety capital of the world. But what they don't tell you is that there's another side to that story, you know. If you're the sobriety capital of the world, you're probably also the relapse capital of the world. And Covina has a ton of recovery houses in it. This small town of 40,000 people supports two Alano clubs and has 17 rehabilitation facilities within its city limits. It's crazy. It is filled with recovery. And it's also filled with relapse. But it's a marvelous place to live. Every time I tell people that I'm from Covina, they say, oh, West Covina. I drive by it all the time. But no, it's Covina. There really is a town called Covina. And we're from it. So Fontana to Covina. I mean, that's not a bad way to go. From drunk to recovery. That's not a bad way to go either. I practiced law for many, many years and never practiced law sober. Now, that sounds different from your story, I think, because many of you are practicing law right now, and you certainly are sober. And many of you, I've heard through the meetings, got sober, started practicing law after you got sober. And I can't even imagine that. I can't imagine practicing law sober because I never did it. You know, I was drunk literally the entire time I practiced law. And I look at it today and I recognize that it was my complete inability to deal with the complexity of life that goes around the practice of law. And so the inability to deal with that complexity of life, the deadlines, the people that you represent that need help, the wonderful things that you could be doing and you're not, the pressures, the courts, everything is so damn hard. And so the only way I knew to deal with it was to drink. And so drinking became my solution. It was my buddy. It was everything I needed. And I loved a Newcastle brown ale at 6 a.m. Really. I mean, it's a breakfast beer. ounces. I know it sounds a little hoity-toity drinking an imported beer for breakfast. You know, some of you guys probably drink just the domestic kind. But I needed that. I really did. I needed it because I was completely unable to handle the complexities of life. And you know, it was even deeper than that. I had this sense that and people who know me today can hardly believe it, that I wasn't worthy. You know, I had this sense that I wasn't worthy of this title that I had. And so I didn't even realize that there were people out there like me until I went to my first lawyers gathering of Alcoholics Anonymous. And we all sat down and we talked about some really, really important stuff that had to do with the way we felt. And I realized that it wasn't just me that sat in that courtroom thinking, oh, that guy must be better than me. He's dressed better than me. He's got to be, he looks like he can argue a case better than I can. Oh, that woman over there, she looks like she went to a fancy school. By the time I'm through looking around the room, I got my head down thinking everybody's better at this than I am. They've got to be. I do not want them to know that I feel less than. We had this magnificent conversation about how we kind of all felt that way. We looked around the room and went, oh my God, I don't want people to know the real me. I better be good today. I better be good. And so I started off in that vein. I started off thinking that life was too hard, that I wasn't good enough. And as Jim says, you know, you dance better when you're drinking. And, you know, dance is really kind of a euphemism for everything you do, right? I mean, dancing is kind of like having a discourse with the person sitting next to you. You know, you drink and you're a better conversationalist. You know, you drink and you're better with relationships, unless you drink too much, like we did. So drinking, you know, it helped me out a great deal until it didn't. I started out as a deputy district attorney, as a lawyer, and I enjoyed that profession because I was too selfish and self-centered to recognize what a damn hypocrite I was. But I enjoyed it even though I was prosecuting people every day for things that I was doing after work. I was prosecuting people every day for DUI when I was driving home drunk after work. I was prosecuting people for possessing things you're not supposed to possess, even though I was in possession of those things as well. I was prosecuting people for living the life that I lived. And I felt good about it. Now that's an unenlightened individual, isn't it? I'm seriously, you look at me today and you go, he's a reverend? So I engaged in that kind of conduct. And today I can look at it and I can tell you, without shame today, because I'm not this person today, but without shame, I can tell you, I was a hypocrite. I lived the life of a hypocrite. And the nice thing about being a prosecutor as a drunk is that you really don't have to be that good at what you do. You know, any prosecutors in here? Good, I can keep on talking a lot. You know, I mean, well, we rode past the gorilla exhibit, you know, as we were at the zoo last night, you know, and I'm thinking, man, you know, a gorilla could win a case as a prosecutor, you know? Seriously, we used to laugh about it, how a trained monkey could handle the case, not so hard. Even as prosecutors, we'd laugh about it, because all you got to do is say, and what happened next? Yeah. And what happened next? But you have to say it in some really, really interesting ways. And, sir, what happened next? Officer, what happened next? So it was a great profession for somebody who wanted to drink, you know? It really was. You have all these trained witnesses up on the witness stand. So I decided, however, through the prodding of my first wife, to move on to greener pastures so that I could make more money, because there wasn't much money in the DA's office back then. And so I went to work at a civil firm, and I hated every second of that. Could not stand it because they had rules. And the rules were you couldn't drink during the day. Now, you might be surprised, but we drank a lot as prosecutors during the day. We'd go out for lunch and we'd have beers and pitchers of beer. And if you didn't have any court appearances in the afternoon, you just didn't even come back to the office. You know, I had an extra set of keys that I never used sitting on my desk. I'd leave my light on and my coat over the chair so people actually thought I was in the library or something, you know? And then I'd never come back. But in this firm, I couldn't do that. I'm in a civil firm, and you can't do that. You actually have to be aware of what other people think of you. and you actually have to be doing the job. And so I hated it. Couldn't stand it. I did well at it because I was the kind of guy that actually pushed myself to great lengths to be as good as I possibly could. And if you ask me about it, I'd tell you about how good I was. And, you know, some people who really don't know you or what kind of job you're doing might even be, you know, swayed by that. They might even believe you. So I always took that chance. And I would tell people how good I was at what I was doing. But at this civil firm, there were too many rules. And so I decided that I was going to open up my own practice. And I was going to practice criminal defense. And there was going to be only one rule. And that rule was that there were no rules. And so I proceeded to actually make that a reality. I brought that from the ethereal world into the world of effects. It was not long before I was operating my own law office with no rules whatsoever. And you know that when you have no rules, you know, you start blurring your boundaries. And I was doing criminal defense for some really interesting people. I was specializing in motorcycle clubs. And there were a lot of them in the Inland Empire, a lot of motorcycle clubs. And those motorcycle clubs were engaged in manufacturing of methamphetamine and all that other kind of stuff, and they really needed lawyers. And so I became a lawyer for several different motorcycle clubs, and I had horrible boundaries. And so I started doing things like taking motorcycles for fees and jewelry and guns and all kinds of things for fees. And I started thinking I was one of them. And so I'd get on the motorcycle and I'd ride around with them, except for one motorcycle club that I represented. If you know the Inland Empire, there's a motorcycle club out there called the Devil's Disciples. Now, they sound really tough, don't they? That sound really tough? But you know the Devil's Disciples because they're the only motorcycle club without motorcycles. They have gone so far down the scale that they've all lost their motorcycles. So you see these guys walking along the road in their leather jackets, and they got the Devil's Disciples on the back, you know, and they're walking because they lost their motorcycles. What a tough guy, a bunch of tough guys, you know. So I thought I was one of them. And I would do the things that they did. And, you know, it was not long before I realized that I really wasn't one of them. You know, it wasn't long before I realized that they were out to get everything that they could from me. And if I did something that was not what they wanted, then they would take some things from me. I mean, you had to be very careful about representing somebody who can hurt you. Seriously. And if there are a group of those people who can hurt you, you have to be extremely careful. So in this circumstance, drinking and practicing law didn't work as well as I'd hoped it would. Because, you know, there were a couple of times when I didn't make those court appearances. There were a couple of times when probably the result wasn't what it should have been. And it wasn't long before I was on their hit list, so to speak. And life turned into a different direction. So here I was, you know, practicing law for groups of people who, sociopathic, and I've got a problem. And the main problem that I had was that I was not recognizing that they needed me because of the problems they had, and if I was going to do the things that they were doing, then I would need a lawyer too. It wasn't long before I started getting arrested for some of the things that they were getting arrested for. Because I think that the worst thing that I did was rationalize my way into this idea that I had to do some things that I shouldn't ought have done in order to be more effective to represent them. Now think how stupid this is. This is pure alcoholic thinking. Pure alcoholic thinking. I'm representing people who are manufacturing methamphetamine. That's my scientific speciality. And my mind tells me that I should learn how to do that so that I can more effectively represent them. Can you understand that thinking, don't you? Yeah, absolutely understand that. And it seemed perfectly obvious to me that I needed to do that. And in order to do that, I had to hang around some people with some serious criminal behavior. And it wasn't long before I came to the attention of the police. Now, when I came to the attention of the police, it became very, very public. I ended up on the front page of certain newspapers, and in that particular area, I love that. What is that? It sounds like a music box. That's probably the 9 o'clock hour, right? They're telling me you got 30 seconds left. So, you come to the attention of the police, you end up on the front page of newspapers, and the interesting thing about that was that we have lawyers in the Inland Empire area that read the newspapers, and that group of people in the Inland Empire area that are in recovery are some of the most loving people I've ever met in my life. You know, they include some of the people sitting right in front of me right here. You know, Rick E., Jim H., Larry K. There are other people here as well from our little group of lawyers in the other bar. But here's what happened. Larry read the newspapers. Larry K. read the newspapers, and he gave me a call at home. And he asked me, well, actually, I didn't answer the phone. He left a message. Asked me if I wanted to go to a meeting at the other bar. Now, I got to tell you, the meeting at the other bar, it was in a place called Bloomington, California, which is the gateway to Fontana. I know that area very, very well. There's only one sidewalk there, and it's owned by a place that I now work for, which is Cedar House Life Change Center. It's a rehabilitation facility and mental health hospital in Bloomington. But it's interesting because the meeting was at Cedar House that I was invited to, and I didn't know anything about Cedar House. So I was invited to go to Cedar House, and I eventually spoke directly with Larry and told him, oh, yeah, I'll definitely be there. And I got pretty close, but on the corner of Cedar and this other street called Santa Ana, there's a bar. It's the Noah Noah Bar, and I ended up in that bar. I was more attracted to the bar than I was to the meeting, so I went in there and I got plenty drunk. He recognized that I hadn't gone to that meeting, so he gives me another call, tenacious. And so I promised him once again that I would go to that meeting, and instead, I made a left turn at the light, and I went down to a member of the Devil's Disciples who did not have a motorcycle but had a house and had plenty of beer in the refrigerator and whiskey and all the other things that I needed at the time. And so I went down there instead of going to the meeting. And I never did make it to a meeting of the other bar before I'd actually gotten sober. And that sobriety came as a result of a series of horrible circumstances that I thought back then was bad luck. That was my worldview back then. My worldview was that I was a victim of bad luck. And if it wasn't for bad luck, I would have no luck at all. And that police officers were picking on me. And they were pulling me over for DUI, not because I was drunk, but because of who I was. I had this idea that I was special. When in fact, you know, the truth is, nobody cares about us, you know? Today we know that. Today we know, they don't even know who I am. But you're going to pull somebody over who's weaving, you know, or somebody like me who combined alcohol with other substances that would keep you up all night, you know, little pills or other things that would keep you up all night. And when you're up 3 or 4 nights in a row, you start doing some weird stuff, and you're going to come to the attention of the police when you're walking around in the middle of the winter at 12 midnight without your shirt on, and you're looking for shiny things. You know, it's true. And you're going to come to the attention of the police. And so I came to the attention of the police, even though those doggone guys were picking on me. And I came to the attention of the police and was arrested the first time and charged with 3 different offenses. And I decided, as any good drunk lawyer would, that I should represent myself. And I did that. I had 3 misdemeanor offenses that I was representing myself on. And so I got up on the witness stand and I testified. I examined myself on the witness stand. And I got a not guilty verdict on all three of those cases, all three of those counts. The only thing is that I lied in my testimony while I was up on the witness stand. And it wasn't long before the district attorney's office figured that out. I mean, they had gone through the heartbreak of losing the case, so they dug into the situation a little bit deeper, and they found that I had lied. And so I actually turned three misdemeanor cases into a relatively serious felony. That's perfect alcoholic thinking, isn't it? I mean, it's great. Man. So, you know, the state bar frowns on perjury convictions. There isn't much you can do that's worse than that. You know, there are people practicing law in the state of California that have actually been convicted of murder. Seriously, second-degree murder, they get out, they go to law school, they take the bar exam. I mean, I know that because I've done the research. But perjury? No. So, two things happened then. That was in 1997. Two things happened. The state of California decided that they did not want me to practice law anymore. And I completely understand that. And then they decided that they wanted to house me for a while. Now, I didn't understand that at all. Because as soon as I got there, I looked around and I said, I actually said it out loud. I said it out loud enough for one of the correctional officers to hear it. You can let me out now. I'm rehabilitated. You can let me out now. Oh, no. Wasn't going to happen. So my wife, who took that opportunity, actually, she wasn't my wife then. As a matter of fact, this is the way this happened was she was my drug dealer, and she's my second wife. The first one got a little tired. First one got a little tired of my activities. Second one, though, she was my drug dealer. Oh, it is amazing to have somebody that good looking with all those drugs. So I hung around her a lot. We fell in love. It was a love at first sight, yeah. And so here I am in an institution, and there she is outside the institution, and she's actually getting some recovery on the outside. She actually has gotten clean and sober. She is in recovery. And so I'm in the penitentiary, and she decides that what she's going to do is start sending me some things in the mail. And those things were pages ripped out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. She would rip 10 pages out at a time, fold it over, put it in an envelope, and send it out to me. You know, and it wasn't long before I had the first 164 pages of the big book. I had them, they were all ripped out pages, but I had them all. And then I had the meeting format, you know, the preamble and all that kind of stuff. She sent me the whole thing. I was getting 4 or 5 letters a day. Everybody in there would look at me like, ooh, who the heck are you, man? But I had the first 164 pages in the meeting format, and I'd had a little belly full of AA before I was sent away because I was trying to impress the judge with my ability to stay sober for a while, which was just really kind of white-knuckle sobriety for 6 months. And I started doing some things that I never thought I would do. I started meetings around my bunk, and it turns out that just about everybody in that place had the same problem I did, you know? Everybody was in there for doing things that they did while under the influence of something. And the second big problem that they had was no connection with the power greater than themselves. And once you get in a place where all you've got is a roll of toilet paper and a little pad to write on so that you have some contact with the outside world, you really need something. You really need a power greater than yourself in order to lean on. And so I had all these people sitting around the bunk joining in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, impromptu, right there. That's the first time I remember doing something for people without asking for anything in return. Honestly, the first time I remember doing something for someone without asking for anything in return. Because, you know, my whole life prior to then, my worldview was like Monopoly. You know, I mean, it's out there and you get as much as you possibly can. My worldview was a Monopoly game. And if you didn't get it, it was because somebody kept you from getting it. And you would get them for doing that. So here I am doing things that I never thought I would do inside of a place I never thought I would be. Man, talk about changes. Now, it wasn't then that I developed this worldview that whatever happens to me adds to my awareness. I was still kind of in the victim mode because I couldn't see anything good about what had happened. I couldn't see that the best things in my life had happened to me right then. I could not see that the best thing that could have happened to me was that something be taken away from me that required that I rebuild everything that I am, everything that I believe, and everything that will cause me to do whatever it is I do in the future. I did not know I was in the process. I was in a phoenix process, you know, burned to the ground, just open and ready for whatever it is that's going to come down the road. You know, an empty vessel. You know, Lord, make me an empty vessel. Guide me. And so there I was in the middle of that process with a bunch of people that I never would have spent any time with. By the time I got to a mainline prison facility, I was looking for a job. And by the way, you find jobs in these facilities. Back then, it's a little different than it is today. But I became the librarian. I became the librarian at the state prison in McFarland, California. And it was a wonderful thing because I was able to get some books in there that were spiritual in nature. And I was allowed to start groups in that facility that allowed people to get together and talk about things that really matter, spiritual things that really matter. And so it had the effect of building upon my understanding of what life was really all about. And I recognized then, right then, in that penitentiary, that Bill Wilson was absolutely right when he on page 77 wrote, "Our primary purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and our fellows about us." Because I was having more fun doing that than anything I had ever done in my life. And I was in a cage. Now, isn't that wild? You have to be in a cage in order to figure out what freedom's all about. I mean, that tells you one thing, that you live your life right here. You live your life right there. It's not about the house you live in. It's not about the car you drive. It's not about the clothes you wear. It's about your thoughts. It's about your higher power. It's about where you go every single moment of every day. And when I say that, I mean inside, deeply. And so when I got out of the penitentiary, I was just burning with desire for this recovery thing. And what I did was go hang around a place that had recovery, and that was a place called Mid Valley Recovery Services in beautiful El Monte, California. If anybody here's ever been to El Monte, you know that it's a, there you go, the hands go up. So, and I imagine if you make it out of El Monte, you are something special, seriously. Because El Monte is the Fontana of Los Angeles County. And so I decided that I would donate my time to a recovery and treatment facility over in El Monte. I wanted to stay sober. I was sober. I had my first birthday, my first AA birthday in prison. And I wanted to stay sober, and I wasn't doing much because I had this resume that was really pretty cool with a great background. I mean, I went to an outstanding educational institution for my undergraduate degree. I went to a great law school. I had all these wonderful, beautiful resume items, but I had this huge gap in my work. You know, you can't write down. You got, you know, librarian at McFarland. It doesn't get you a job. So I donated my time at Mid Valley Recovery Services. I went in and I said, "I want to volunteer. I'll do anything you got." And they said, "Oh, great. There's a mop over there. You can mop the floors. You can go in the restrooms and clean the restrooms. And, you know, we've got some other things for you to do when you're finished with that." And so I happily started doing those things. And they noticed something. They noticed that I was there when I was supposed to be there. And I did what I was supposed to do. And I had, at that time in my life, developed two real solid principles that I wanted to live my life by, and that was to be where I was supposed to be and do what I was supposed to do. And I figured if I was going to be where I was supposed to be and do what I was supposed to do, I wouldn't get in trouble anymore. I mean, that's my thinking, you know, really simple stuff. Like, just be where you're supposed to be, you know, just do what you're supposed to do. But it seems that that's not what most people live by. Because I started standing out just by being where I was supposed to be and doing what I was supposed to do. So here I am 30 days doing all that stuff. I'm there. I finished the job. And I get asked to be an employee there. You know, they looked at me and said, God, you know, you have been here and you've done that. How would you like to be a counselor here? And that's back in those days when you didn't have to have much except some sobriety and maybe, you know, an ability to write. And so I said, fantastic. And they said, well, you're going to need to go to school. You're going to have to go to this institution or that school, or you're going to have to go to this junior college or whatever you choose. You're going to need a little higher education down the line. I said, great, sign me up. And I started doing it. And it was about 6 months after that that I was actually the director of the program. You know, I'm a principles guy. You know, I love the principles that are associated with Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I do workshops on principles that are associated with the steps, you know. I'm really a fan of honesty and faith and trust and understanding and courage. I'm really a fan of all of the things that go along with the steps. And so I loved spiritual principles, but I added those two spiritual principles that I just told you about to that list of things that I intended to do for the rest of my life. And those two things seem to have been the most amazing generators of happiness and wealth and love in my life of anything that's ever happened to me. Be where you're supposed to be. Do what you're supposed to do. And people notice that. And so here I am. I'm the director of a program in El Monte. Man, I've made it. I have arrived. You know, the city is mine. For about 4 years. You know, some of those character defects that I had, you know, just did not go away either. I got to be honest about that, you know. And I was running somebody else's program, and that other person happened to be my boss. And when she didn't do things right, I let her know. And when she didn't do it my way, by God, I let her know. And she'd had enough of that after about 4 years. She'd had enough of that and decided that we should separate. Absolutely. You should head on down the road. So I went to my meeting, my home group, and I said, I've been fired from my job. And you know what they did? No sympathy. They clapped. I got a standing ovation from that group. I did. They were so excited for me. You know, once again, I didn't recognize that worldview that I had today is really an awesome worldview. That everything that happens to me adds to my awareness. Everything that happens to me has the potentiality, if I look at it correctly, of being very, very good for me and for those people around me. So I didn't see it as that. I saw it as a horrible thing. I went home and I said, we're going to live in a tent, honey. You know, we're done. You know, I lost my job. We're done. And she said, you know, what she always says, that there's a solution to this, Greg. And I'd look at her in the eyes and I'd say, I know. And she'd say, the solution is to widen your world. And the solution is not to go hide around this thing. It's to widen your world. Make it bigger. Add some people to your life. And so that meeting of the other bar in Bloomington that I didn't go to when I was invited by Larry Kay, I went to. Because she told me I should. The invitation was still open. It's a standing invitation to that. I remember walking into that meeting at the other bar and seeing people that I really, really needed to connect with again. You know, this thing that we have here, a bunch of drunks working with one another, helping each other to live one day at a time, do the best we possibly can, is fantastic. It's a connector. It's an incredible connector. But you add two connectors to it, and you really got it going. We got two connectors. The first connector is that we're all alcoholic. The second connector is that we're lawyers. And I'll tell you, when you get two connectors, you can move on to the third, that we all have these issues and those issues, and we're more alike than we are different. you start to see the similarities, and you start to recognize that you're my brother, you're my sister, we come from the same source, and life is different than I thought it was. You go to meetings where people talk about that stuff, they really unload and they dump the things inside of them that they would never tell another human being. And I'm not talking about the bad stuff, I'm talking about the corny stuff. You know, I'm talking about the stuff that would embarrass you in front of somebody who's not an alcoholic. I'm talking, how many people do you sit next to at any sort of function that's not alcoholic and start talking about your higher power? You know, they'd hand you a robe and a pair of paper slippers. You know, they'd send you off to the funny farm. We go to these places and we start talking about that stuff. We start talking about the things that are important without embarrassment. And there's something healing about that. Without those connectors, you know, that kind of stuff wouldn't happen. Alcoholics Anonymous and ILAA and the other bar and groups like us are amazing. We vibrate at a very high level of consciousness. And I'm not just tooting our horn. You'll understand why I say this when I say this. But we vibrate at that high level of consciousness because we have unconditional love. You can't find it many other places. I'll bet you if you looked in your own life, you might not be able to find it anywhere but in your groups. Because we welcome people back no matter what they've done. It doesn't matter what you've done. We say welcome. That's unconditional love. I mean, how many times have you done that with your family? You welcome your family back with my God, you stole from me. We do that in Alcoholics Anonymous. We have unconditional love. This is a place where we can actually be at such a high level of consciousness that we start doing things like helping others. Now, that vibrates at a pretty doggone high level of consciousness, too. I mean, service is an amazing thing. Each one teach one. Learn this program well enough to give it away. Save lives. What a concept. So I learned those things from these people. I learned those really deep things. You know, here are a bunch of people sitting around a table that would not want anybody in the world other than those people in the room to know some of those deep, dark things. Because, you know, don't you know, we have an image that we have to uphold. It'd be nice if we could go out in the world and tell everybody about how, our lives were at one point in time. But, you know, we might get less clients that way. And so we're a little concerned about that. You know, some of my biggest heroes in the world are those people that have walked into very, very difficult and dangerous, with quotation marks around it, circumstances, professionally dangerous circumstances, with seemingly no fear. And the one person that does that all the time was your speaker last night, Jim H. Now, when I first met Jim H., I knew that he'd been the state bar president in 2005-2006, but I didn't know that he had walked into that arena touting recovery, looking for people he could help, talking about alcoholism and drug addiction and mental health and how people were actually suffering from those diseases and needed help. And he was willing to share his story to let people know that anybody could have alcoholism. You know, it's no respecter of persons. And I realized that when he walked into those places and started telling his story, that people were looking at him like he was some sort of pariah. People were looking at him and going, really? So that's who you are. And he braved that. He braved it. Every moment he was with people talking about these important things, he braved ostracism. And those are my heroes today. You know, and I see people all the time braving ostracism. So I learned to do that. I learned to say, I'm Greg Dorst. I'm an alcoholic. I want people to know my last name. I don't do it in front of a television. When there are reporters in the audience, I don't do that. But I want you to know my last name. Because I want you to be able to get a hold of me. You know, today I am the chief executive officer of a recovery and treatment hospital that does mental health work. It's on a 10-acre campus. You know, I look at that and I say to myself, every single day, what path did I take? You can't get there from where I was to where I am today. You can't do that. You can't. I got so interested in helping people that I decided to take some classes. Started taking some classes that had to do with some really interesting philosophical and theological ideas. And I became enamored with it. I became enamored with defining my higher power, recognizing now that it changes with every face I meet. I got enamored with ideas of spirit. I got enamored with ideas of spirit that could help people. I wanted to learn about that, so I started taking classes. It took me about 7 years. I ended up with a master's in theology. I didn't head in that direction, but I just did it because I was interested. And so today I'm the minister at a wonderful place in Covina, sobriety capital of the world, called the Sanctuary for Spiritual Living. And it's a great place, and some of my friends here have been there. It's a magnificent place where a lot of really neat stuff happens. And every time I get up there and talk to people, I talk to them recognizing that I need to be of service to them. And the way to do that is to let them know that there is a way to live a better life. And I'm not afraid to share mine. I'm not afraid to tell them exactly what happened to me, who I was, what I did, the changes that I made, and who I am today. Now, I know there are a lot of people in positions like that that hide the true them. They hide who they are. You know, every single day, it seems, there's somebody in the ministry who's being called out for this or for that. Or some person's come forward and says the adulterous affairs and stealing money and all of this other kind of stuff. I mean, they're not who we think they are. But I make it a point, because some of the people that have taught me these things in this room today, Rick, allow me to be as honest as I possibly can. I pull no punches. I am who I am. And if you don't like what I've been through, just stick around a little bit longer. You'll like what I've become. So I recognize today that being an example is a good way to spread the message. You know, you can't touch a whole lot of people in face-to-face conversation, but if you're a good example, you can touch a whole lot of people. So I continue to be where I'm supposed to be and do what I'm supposed to do. I continue to follow those two principles that have meant so much in my life. And I haven't had a drink for almost 16 years. And here's the beauty of it. I haven't missed it. You know, my worldview is different today, totally different. I changed the way I look at things. And when I did that, the things I look at change. I don't see the same world today. I don't see the same people today. I had this horrible idea that I hated people. People were evil and filled with vitriol, and I should watch out for every single one of you. But today I have the opposite view. My worldview is completely different. I want to be with you. I want to share life with you. I see that God operates through you. You know, and I even go a step further than that. That Spirit, Source, is in, around, and through each and every one of you, acting as you in my life. My life's gotten better as a result of that worldview. My life continues to get better every single day. I have a lot of people to thank for that. But most of all, I have a program that allowed me to do some things that I'd never done, to become a person that I never, ever even thought I could become. So I'll tell you, I am excited as heck to go to our next convention, you know? I am so excited to go to Tennessee. I know that they'll recognize me as a star there. They will. It won't be long before my first album will come out after I've been in Tennessee. It's all good. So it's with great delight that I say, I'm so happy to know you, my new friends. Thank you.